Such was Davy's predicament late in 2005. He feared an imminent rebel invasion aimed at overthrowing his regime, but he lacked adequate means to defend his palace. The absurdity, from his perspective, was that at the very moment this threat loomed, he was becoming richer than many of his neighboring dictators, or authoritarian leaders, as Washington sometimes preferred. Under the 1988 oil production contract, as world oil prices rose and ExxonMobil recouped the costs of its initial oil field investments faster than expected, the revenue flowing to Deby also soared. It now exceeded all previous projections. His government took in $300 million in 2005. Yet Deby could not spend his own money freely because of his good governance compact with the World Bank. He was banned from buying as many guns, desert vehicles, and attack aircraft as he felt he needed to defeat Bashir's rebel proxies. Deby had gone along with the surrender of some of Chad's sovereignty to the World Bank back in 2000 because it was necessary to get the country's oil flowing. He was not going to surrender his office to a foreign invader to preserve the plausibility of some Westerner's utopian ambition. "It was very hard to explain to Chadian opinion that we must buy weapons," recalled Mohammed Hossein, a minister in Deby's cabinet. "So we did not develop real power to respond to attacks coming from outside. Unfortunately, in front of us, we don't have politicians, we have technicians. The World Bank and IMF sent us technicians who don't care about the security of the country." Late in 2005, Deby announced that he would introduce amendments to Chadian law that would break his government's bonds with the World Bank. By doing so, he threatened to upend the nation-building compact and international financial rules that had prevailed, however raggedly, long enough to reward ExxonMobil for enduring high political risk in Chad. Just as the corporation reached break-even and its local profits began to gush, Deby's desperation for money and guns threatened to bring the whole project down. Ron Royal, an engineer with many years at the corporation, managed ExxonMobil's country office in Jemena. In addition to his security team, a handful of expatriate and Chadian public affairs advisers, lobbyists and analysts, advised him. Royal reported in turn to the Africa Division in Houston. Until the crisis that erupted that autumn, Royal's job had been merely grinding and thankless. Idriss Deby paid little attention to the details of his country's oil contracts or operations. One American embassy cable described him as terribly ill-advised and grossly uninformed about oil. As a result, Deby's minions, cabinet ministers, labor union allies, governors in the South, and other assorted rent-seekers, felt free to harass ExxonMobil at every turn, seeking money to skim or for other advantages. In addition to the chronic thefts from ExxonMobil facilities, Royal had to respond to wildcat strikes, court cases arising from labor disputes, public protests, complaints by environmentalists, delays and threatened fees imposed by immigration officials who issued visas, customs delays, and other challenges. Chad's politicians and labor leaders might be poor, and some of them might be unsophisticated, but they had been schooled in obduracy and provocation by French colonialists, which made them formidable. A typical matter in Ron Royal's inbox was the announcement, during 2005, by the Chadian civil aviation authorities that because ExxonMobil had overlooked a certain legal provision, the corporation would have to immediately start paying the country's struggling state-owned airline $150,000 a month in royalties for the right to avoid having ExxonMobil workers fly on the airline's planes. Chadian officials also were deeply suspicious about the relatively low prices the country's sour, heavy oil attracted on world markets. Some of their worries seemed irrational. It was as much in ExxonMobil's interest as in Chad's to receive the highest possible per barrel price. Yet the wide gap, more than $20 per barrel, between the price of Chad's oil and the prices for more attractive benchmark blends of oil that were published in world newspapers, raised suspicions with Deby and his aides. ExxonMobil flew some of Deby's oil advisors to Fairfax, Virginia, and London to show them how ExxonMobil bought and sold oil on the world market, and how it negotiated to win the best possible prices for Chadian barrels from shipment to shipment. Even this show-and-tell had limited impact. Afterward, one of the Chadian delegates, Abdelkarim Abaker, remarked to an American diplomat that the visit solidified the question of why Doba crude was priced so low when the price of oil in the international markets was priced at such a high level. And he argued if ExxonMobil was truly willing to communicate openly about the issue, it would have organized this visit a long time ago. Ron Royal and his team met regularly with American diplomats in N'Djamena, including Mark Wall, the ambassador, who had succeeded the part-time novelist Chris Goldthwait. Wall was a career diplomat, a thin, professional, silver-haired man with extensive experience in troubled countries. Normally, Royal did not ask the embassy to lobby on ExxonMobil's behalf with Debbie or his aides. ExxonMobil took care of its labor, security, and government lobbying hassles on its own. That changed during the first weeks of 2006. The crisis Ron Royal and ExxonMobil faced that winter was instigated from Washington. Its principal architect was the World Bank's new leader, Paul Wolfowitz. In his previous position as Deputy Secretary of Defense, Wolfowitz had been an intellectual leader and a passionate defender of the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam Hussein. In 2005, as the war descended into chaos, and as its costs in blood and treasure to the United States rose precipitously, Wolfowitz left the Pentagon. He arrived at the World Bank in a complex political and psychological position. He was deeply unpopular in many parts of the world, unrepentant about Iraq, and yet he seemed anxious to demonstrate his commitment to poverty alleviation and liberal development goals. Presented in his first months on the job with the conundrum of Idriss Deby's defiance of World Bank principles of good governance, Paul Wolfowitz decided to make an example of him.